Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, QTAM Tolling and First to File Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On May 26, 2015, the Supreme Court issued its decision in Kellogg Brown and Root Services v. United States X. Rel. Carter. This case involves two questions. The first is whether the statute of limitations for a claim of civil fraud against the government brought by a relator, who is a private individual bringing suit on behalf of the government, can be indefinitely tolled by the Wartime Suspension of Limitations Act, or WSLA. The second question asks whether the False Claims Act's first-to-file rule, which presents an incentive for relators to be the first to bring claims of fraud, simply requires that only one case can be pending at a time, or requires that once a case has been filed, all cases based upon the same facts and alleging the same type of fraud are barred. Justice Alito delivered the opinion of a unanimous court, which held that, one, the WSLA applies only to criminal and not civil claims, and, two, that the FCA's first-to-file bar only keeps claims out of court while related claims are still active, not in perpetuity, and that petitioners' reading of the term pending as being synonymous with first filed would improperly bar suits having nothing to do with the merits of the case. To discuss the case, we have Marcia G. Madsen, who is a partner at Mayer Brown, and Christopher A. Bowen, who is an associate at Arendt Fox. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Ms. Madsen.
Good afternoon, everyone. Chris and I are delighted, actually, to be able to talk about the Supreme Court's decision earlier this week in Kellogg Brown and Root Services versus Carter. It's a False Claims Act case, and a topic that, at least to my recollection, is not typically or frequently discussed with the Federalist Society, but one in which I think both Chris and I think the Federalist Society should have a great deal of interest. In the KBR versus Carter case, Carter was actually a QTAM relator who had filed a case involving KBR's participation in water purification activities in Iraq during the Iraq War, and he claimed that essentially KBR had overbilled the government or billed the government for activities that had not occurred, and so he was filing under the False Claims Act in an attempt to recover the bounty that relators are entitled to under that statute, which led to a very long sequence of events that we're going to be talking about today. In its decision earlier this week, the Supreme Court reversed a decision of the Fourth Circuit, which had applied the Wartime Suspension of Limitations Act, which I'm sure we will revert to the WSLA as a shorthand form as we talk here today. They applied the WSLA to extend the limitations period that's applicable to claims in a False Claims Act action. The WSLA extends the statute of limitations. And there was some concern, particularly among defendants, government contractors who are Chris's clients and my clients, that it had effectively been extended indefinitely by use of the WSLA. There are several other circuits that had also ruled similarly to the Fourth Circuit, and the effect on defendants is to subject them to substantial FCA liabilities on stale claims that are getting older and older the longer the statute is extended. So the first part of our discussion today is going to be about the court's ruling on the WSLA, where it held that it was not applicable to Civil False Claims Act cases. And then the second part of our discussion is going to be about one of the jurisdictional bars in the False Claims Act, the first-to-file bar. I'm going to talk briefly about the WSLA, and I think from the perspective of the defense bar, the decision was an important victory for government contractors, as well as other businesses, which principally could include healthcare companies, but also anyone who does business with the federal government in any capacity, so grantees, people who participate in other types of federal programs where there's at least a potential financial benefit. So it's an important decision to all of those categories of federal program participants. I want to just talk for a moment about what the Civil False Claims Act is. I think probably many people are familiar with it. Some may not be. It's an old statute. It was enacted during the Civil War. It was substantially amended in 1986. The things that make it unique as a government enforcement tool are its low intent requirement, the knowing standard. This is a civil fraud statute, so the knowing standard is not criminal intent. It's much less than that. It's basically reckless disregard or acting in deliberate ignorance of the truth or falsity of information that a party possesses. So it's not a difficult proof burden for a relator or for the government, and it's a preponderance of the evidence standard. The statute allows for treble damages plus penalties plus interest and attorney's fees in cases that are fully litigated. With respect to the statute of limitations, the statute provides that it's no more than 6 years after the violation or 3 years after the date when the facts are known or should have been known, but in any event, no more than 10 years after the violation was committed. The Wartime Suspension of Limitations Act could extend that 10-year period for a much longer time, and as I said earlier, some defendants have been concerned that given the wartime footing that the United States has been on since 2001, could be a very long time, potentially indefinite, at least from a corporate perspective. The Wartime Suspension of Limitations Act was originally enacted shortly after World War I. It was intended to apply to wartime fraud problems. It was then reenacted during World War II. Until 2008, the WSLA permitted the statute of limitations to be suspended during wartime and for 3 years after the end of hostilities. Congress expanded the WSLA in 2008 to apply when Congress enacts specific authorization for the use of armed forces. And in 2008, it also increased the suspension period to 5 years after the termination of hostilities. And the timing, as you can see, could be potentially long. And we're going to talk in a minute about how the statute gets triggered. There's been some debate about that the Supreme Court didn't resolve. During the last several years, relators, QI-TAM relators, have argued that the False Claims Act statute of limitations was suspended under the Wartime Statute of Limitations Act during the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I'm going to talk, I think, separately in a second about an interesting discussion in the Fourth Circuit's opinion regarding what constitutes war for purposes of the Wartime Statute of Limitations Act, but that's a little bit of a detour, so I'll come back to that. The argument that has been made for the statute of limitations suspension has been made not only in cases that involve, like KBR did, activities in a conflict zone, but also in cases that don't have anything to do with military contracts, in healthcare cases, in cases involving civilian agencies. There's a case probably in 2012, U.S. versus BNP Paribas, which is a case involving a Department of Agriculture credit guarantee program that the Wartime Statute of Limitations was used to extend the statute there. So the WSLA has the potential to dramatically expand the reach of the False Claims Act and require companies, government contractors among them, to litigate claims that are very, very old, with the result that companies frequently do not have the evidence, the witnesses, the material they need to defend themselves. And the cases can, the older they get, the more expensive they can get. The Supreme Court in KBR versus Carter resolved the question of the application of the Wartime Statute of Limitations on the basis of statutory language. There was a debate in the case, and one of the reasons it made it to the Supreme Court in the first place was an argument between the defense bar, the Department of Justice, and the relators bar about whether the Wartime Statute of Limitations Act suspended the statute of limitations in civil cases or only in criminal cases. And the Supreme Court said, in resolving it, of course, they always make it sound easy, right? You wonder why, how the case got there. But the Supreme Court said that the WSLA suspension of the statute of limitations applies to the running of any statute of limitations that's applicable to an offense involving fraud or attempted fraud against the United States or any agency thereof. And the Supreme Court went on to analyze that language as offense being in the criminal context. It was relevant to the court that the Wartime Statute of Limitations Act is in Title 18 as opposed to anywhere else. And although the court noted that, you know, that's not dispositive, it's an indication of what Congress had intended. The court went on to explain that when it was first enacted in 1921, the Wartime Statute of Limitations Act applied to offenses involving defrauding or attempts to defraud the government that are, and this phrase turns out to be important, quote, now indictable under any existing statutes, close quote. The WSLA was amended in 1944, toward the end of World War II, to delete the phrase now indictable under any statute, and it also suspended the limitations period for 3 years after the cessation of hostilities was proclaimed. For several years now, the Department of Justice and relators have argued repeatedly that the 1944 removal of the now indictable language expanded the application of the Wartime Statute of Limitations Act to civil claims, and it's been used pretty aggressively to bring very old cases. So it's just been a bone of contention for the defense community. In KBR, the Supreme Court unanimously rejected this argument as, quote, most improbable. It's Justice Alito's opinion, and he's quite pointed about his views. He says, you know, he explains why he thinks it's most improbable. He indicated that deleting the now indictable language but leaving the word offense is simply, in his view, too obscure to substantially expand the reach of the WSLA. And he pointed out again in his view that fundamental changes in a statute typically aren't that subtle. If Congress intends to do something that would radically change the reach of statutes that's as important as changing the statute of limitations, they would typically be clear so that everybody knows what they've done. Companies know what they've done. Individuals know what they've done. And he said a better explanation is really that in 1944, when Congress made the WSLA applicable to offenses prospectively, not just to offenses that had occurred during the war, but offenses that would occur during future conflicts, they had to also remove the now indictable language to affect that change, and it really doesn't mean anything more than that. And the opinion also indicates basic rule of legal construction, which even if it was ambiguous, since it's a suspension of a limitations period, it should be narrowly construed and interpreted in favor of repose. So it seemed to be a very simple resolution of a problem that's been kind of bedeviling the community for a while. I wanted to just talk a little bit about the Fourth Circuit's opinion. The Supreme Court didn't address this aspect of the Fourth Circuit's opinion except in passing, but the Fourth Circuit had a long discussion in its opinion about what's the triggering event to apply the wartime statute of limitations suspension. And the Supreme Court kind of brushed this discussion aside by saying, since we've decided it only applies in the criminal context but not in the civil context, we don't really need to talk about the triggering event or when the United States is at war. But there's such a good discussion of that topic in the Fourth Circuit's opinion, I just wanted to talk about it for a second. The Fourth Circuit actually relied on some language in a Fifth Circuit case to talk about the WSLA having three components, a triggering clause, a suspension period, and a termination clause, and pointing out that the Supreme Court has previously held that the WSLA applies only to offenses committed after the triggering clause and obviously before the termination clause. So there's a discussion in the opinion about what triggers the wartime statute of limitations. And it was important to the Fourth Circuit whether or not the suspension period was in effect. So they looked at how the statute had developed and the fact that courts have been in disagreement for a long time as to which version of the WSLA would apply before offenses that occurred, well, for, to offenses that occurred before 2008, and also whether the prior to 2008 version of the statute required a formal declaration of war. And the Fourth Circuit concluded, after looking at a couple of things, they concluded that a formal declaration of war was not necessary because what, regardless of which version you applied, whether it's the 2008 version with the war powers reference or to an earlier version with a declaration of war requirement, they found the United States was at war because it was in a conflict at the time these events occurred. And the Fourth Circuit also said they believe requiring a declared war would be unduly formalistic since we really haven't had one of those since World War II. And we've had Korea, Vietnam, Kosovo, Iraq, and other things, but no declaration of war. So the Fourth Circuit was satisfied that the suspension period was, in fact, triggered and it didn't need all of these formalities. And they were also satisfied that at the time of this opinion, neither Congress nor the President had declared those hostilities at an end. So they viewed the statute as applicable. And they went on also to discuss the topic of whether it's criminal or civil. As I said, the Supreme Court didn't choose to take on the whether it's a wartime act or not. So just in conclusion on this first point, for the defense bar, the recognition that the suspension period does not apply to civil cases is a big win from this Supreme Court decision. It means there are a lot of stale claims that won't be litigated. It means there are a lot of cases that have been underway that will no longer be underway. And in fact, I don't know if there are people on this call who listen to the oral argument, but at the oral argument, KBR's counsel was asked whether this would resolve his concerns. And he said if this issue, the case was decided on this issue, would resolve KBR's concerns. So it's a big deal, but it's not the only issue the court discussed. So I'm going to turn this over to Chris to talk about the first to file bar.
Thank you, Marcia. Important to understanding the court's decision in the first to file bar is knowing what the implicit deal is between relators and the government. The idea is that the relator brings to the government information, and that permits the relator to A, have the government investigate it, but B, prosecute the claim, and if he recovers, he gets treble damages plus interest plus attorney's fees, and then he gets to keep a third of the damages and hands over to the rest of the government. The government implicitly says, we will let you keep a third of what we are entitled to because you've told us about this fraud, which we might not have otherwise known. The problem that arose in the pre-1944 version of the False Claims Act was that there was no knowledge requirement. What would happen was that in the Supreme Court case of United States ex rel Marcus V. Hess, a guy happened to be hanging out at the courthouse. He overheard an indictment being read regarding bid rigging on a federal contract, and he filed a claim saying, hey, they've committed a False Claims Act violation. Please give me my damages. To the government, this didn't serve the purpose. He hadn't brought anything new of which they were not already aware. And so in 1944, Congress added a provision that said, quote, unless the government proceeds with the action, the court shall dismiss an action brought by a person on discovering the action is based on evidence or information the government had when the action was brought. This amendment to the False Claims Act was clearly aimed at cases like Hess, which in the courts have universally called the parasitic cases. In 1986, as Marcia mentioned, Congress substantially loosened the False Claims Act, seeking to make it easier for relators to bring claims. And one of the things was they deleted that straight, very easy to understand government knowledge provision and added three provisions. The first one is the one that is at issue here in this case, which says, when a person brings an action under this subsection, no person, other than the federal government, may intervene or bring a related action based on the facts in the pending action. And pending is the word the Supreme Court is going to give a lot of attention to. The other two relevant jurisdictional bars are later in the statute, which says, in no event may a person bring an action which is based on allegations which are the subject of a civil suit or administrative civil money penalty proceeding in which the government is already a party. Once again, the idea is if the government already knows about the fraud, there's no point in giving the relator a third of what the government could recover for telling the government that which it already knows. The final bar is known as the original source because it says the court shall dismiss a claim if substantially the same allegations were already publicly disclosed in a federal criminal proceeding in which the government is an agent or party, or in a federal or congressional report or from the news media, unless the guy telling you the stuff the government already knows and is bringing a suit under is the original source of that information. So that's the context of the deal that the government implicitly makes with relators, is you have to, generally you have to bring them something new. The second thing to remember is the procedure under the False Claims Act. When the relator brings his lawsuit, he's got to file it under seal, and he doesn't get to do anything with it for a while. The court, the relator then serves it on the relevant AUSA in the district in which the case is filed. The AUSA then has, under the statute, 60 days, but usually extended to longer than that. As pointed out in some of the amicus briefs, it frequently extends to 2 years, to investigate it. And at the conclusion of that, the government has to say, we are either intervening, in which case the government doesn't have to, but always does, file its own complaint, or the government can say, we choose not to intervene, in which case the relator can go and bring the case himself and do discovery himself. So anytime you see a relator who's brought his own case and isn't proceeding with the Department of Justice really leading the charge, you know that the Department of Justice has already looked at the case and made the decision that it doesn't feel the need to intervene, whether it's because of merits or because of other considerations. So as Marcia mentioned, Mr. Carter had a very long road to the courthouse. Suffice it to say, he filed his claim in 06, about a year after he got back from Iraq, and things sort of puttered along. The court dismissed his claim for failure to plead fraud with particularity. He then refiled. The case that the government declined to intervene, the case then went through discovery, and then a month before trial, the DOJ hopped up and said, oh, wait, there's another pending case. Thus, this has to be dismissed under the pending case bar. This, of course, made nobody happy. The case that was pending was out in California. It was a case by the name of Thorpe. Mr. Carter appeals the dismissal. While he's appealing it, Mr. Thorpe's case is dismissed for failure to prosecute, and then he tries to refile his claim. The district court dismisses his new complaint, saying you've got a new first-to-file bar because your claim is still pending because you've got your appeal going on in the Fourth Circuit. So he then pulls his appeal and refiles his 2011 complaint, and then they proceed from there. At other times, we also get an action in Maryland. At another time, there's an action in Texas, which posed problems. And eventually, the court says, no, these other cases are the case in California, Thorpe, was pending when you filed it. Therefore, even though it's dismissed, you are still barred by the first-to-file bar. So he takes an appeal. Now, the Fourth Circuit had said, well, under the word pending, it has to mean that the case is active. If it's already been dismissed, that means that it's no longer pending, and therefore we can proceed from there. And this was appealed as well to the Fourth and to the Supreme Court. In their briefs, KBR argued that pending, in the context of the language, simply is referring to which case results in the dismissal. Specifically, remember, the language was, when a person brings an action in this subsection, no person other than the government may intervene or bring a related action on the facts underlying the pending action. There is a split among the circuits. The First and D.C. Circuit had ruled that the prior dismissed action did bar later actions. The Fourth, Seventh, and Tenth Circuit had held no. The correct thing to do is to say that pending means that it's still alive, And once it's no longer alive, then another relator can go and file its bar. The Supreme Court agreed with the relator and also agreed with the Fourth Circuit. It said that the interpretation does not comport With any known usage of the term pending, under this interpretation, Marbury v. Madison is still pending, so is the trial of Socrates. One would argue whether Mr. Socrates would feel that his trial is still pending, but that's what the Supreme Court said. Justice Alito also said that KBR's interpretation pushed pending beyond the breaking point, knowing that the effect would bar all subsequent suits, even if the dismissal had nothing to do with the merit, and noted multiple interpretive issues with the FCA. Justice Alito was sympathetic to the arguments KBR made in his brief, where it said, look, if we don't interpret pending the way we say, then the problem that arises is we're going to be reluctant to settle, because you settle with a relator, you get the approval of the Department of Justice to settle the case and the approval of the court, you dismiss the action, and then all of a sudden another person could pop up. This might seem far-fetched. However, in the Fourth Circuit, this did in fact happen in May v. Purdue Pharma, where the first case was dismissed because of the settlement, and then someone came on with an extraordinarily similar case. And they said, no, first to file means you're barred, and they also made a claim preclusion argument. And the Fourth Circuit rejected both of those. Justice Alito's response to this was, one, yes, the FCA poses, as he put it, interpretive challenges to try and find resolution, but that's not the court's problem. And two, you can always rely on claim preclusion. Now, in the Purdue Pharma case, claim preclusion was exactly what the defendants had brought. Now, that got rejected. Why? Well, claim preclusion requires identity of parties, identity of actions, and a final judgment. They said, well, we've got the final judgment. See, he dismissed his case. And remember, the DOJ has to sign off on that deal as a practical matter. Second, we've got identity of parties because the real party in interest is the United States. The relator's just making it his job to bring the United States' claim. And we have an identity of actions. The complaints were extraordinarily similar. But the Fourth Circuit in Purdue Pharma said, no, there is not an identity of parties because the relator is different. Now, that obviously poses a big problem for companies, because if you've got a claim out there and you want to settle it, you're going to be reluctant, as KBR pointed out in its briefs, to settle for the full value of the claim because you're going to say yes, but there's another guy who could potentially come along. There may be ways around this problem posed in Purdue Pharma, and the Fourth Circuit in Purdue Pharma expressed extreme skepticism at the relator's claim that it was merely a coincidence that the two complaints were so extraordinarily similar, but said it was a factual issue that required a full hearing. But it certainly did leave a potential issue out there for government contractors who are seeking to resolve these cases. As one final note of analysis, I think Justice Alito's opinion dealing with the pending claim issue simply ignores the fact that for purposes of pending actions, if you say, no, it wasn't pending, then you're ignoring the context of the fact that the government already knows about all the allegations that could be brought in subsequent claims and has made a decision not to intervene, not to bring it on behalf of itself. It's important to note that in Thorpe, the California case that was the original cause of the dismissal, the case was dismissed for failure to prosecute. That means not only did Mr. Thorpe think it not worth his time to continue with this case, but the Department of Justice had made its decision that this was not worth its time. Thus, I think by ignoring the identity of interest and the extensive involvement in the Department of Justice in any settlement, any litigation involving the False Claims Act, Justice Alito may have permitted government contractors to be beset by more relators than Congress intended.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.